I will call this remote hearing of the Local Government Division to order. Today is March 3rd, 2021. And we are using ruling point 1001, where the House information will be live streaming this portion. And I apologize, I just lost my script. Okay. And all remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take the attendance, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Representative Mason.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Quam.
Present.
Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Mecklen. Representative.
Present.
Olson.
Present.
Representative Joaquin.
Present.
All members are present.
Okay. A quorum is present. The next item on the agenda is to approve the minutes for Wednesday, February 24th, 2021. Representative Elkins, have you read the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I will move their approval.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. The minutes stand approved as read. Okay, our first order of business today is Representative Becker Finn. And if, I'm going to move House File 702. And Representative, if you would like to start the presentation.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 702, this is our second time bringing this bill forward. And essentially what this does is it allows cities to license their hotels. And this may on its face seem like something that it isn't. And what this is really about is protecting the public safety of our communities and giving cities another tool to deal with property owners who may not be helpful in managing the crimes that are occurring on their properties. And so I am actually going to spend the bulk of my time I'm going to give to my testifiers. I have this is a top priority of the city of Roseville. It has been for a couple of years, and we're going to go first to Chief Schneider, who is our chief of police in the city of Roseville.
And Chief, if you would say your name for the record and proceed, please. And welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Erica Schneider. And good morning, and thank you for allowing me to come and speak today. The Roseville Police Department is very much in support of the hotel licensing bill. Over the past few years, the Roseville Police Department has seen a dramatic increase in crime and public safety concerns at a few of our hotels, specifically three of them. The crimes include human trafficking, robberies, shootings, and sexual assault. We have tried to work with the hotel's management owners, but they've refused to address the increase in crime. We currently do not have the local control to effect change to address the public safety problems. The increase in crime and public safety have impacted not only the guests staying at the hotels, but the businesses and residents in the area surrounding the hotels. One daycare center reported the staff and parents no longer felt safe because of the foot traffic coming to and from one of our problem hotels. Recently, a corporate group that stays at one of our different upscale Roseville hotels reported that they were thinking of pulling their contract because of crime in the area generated from one of these problem hotels. Just a few quick statistics to share with you today. In Roseville, we have a total of 12 hotels. Of those, in the past 3 years, the three problem hotels were host to 74% of the overall police calls to Roseville hotels and motels. In the past 3 years, we've responded to a total of 21 fights. At various hotels, 17 out of those 21 fights were at our three problem hotels. For weapon calls, 13 of the 16 calls were at our three problem hotels. And we've had 14 robberies reported at hotels, with 13 out of the 14 occurring at one of our three problem hotels. Although the stats are certainly troublesome, it's the victims and those being trafficked out of the hotels that is the most concern. And just a quick few stories to share with you. In 2017, Victor Lynch was charged with third-degree murder in the death of a 28-year-old female. He mixed and administered a lethal dose of methamphetamine and heroin at one of our problem hotels. He then took steps to cover up the death. He had an extensive criminal history, including serious drug offenses. But what is most concerning is that he lived at the hotel and he was the on-site maintenance worker. Last month, Roseville officers assisting with inspections learned that there had been a shooting, and it was never reported by the staff. And I'll close with the last story that's probably the most troublesome. In April of 2019, a woman staying at one of our problem hotels was the victim of a horrific sexual assault. She was violently and repeatedly raped by two men. When the males left, the victim called the front desk asking for help because her cell phone was dead. The staff never called the police, and they never went to check on her. When help never came, she finally worked up the courage to run to the desk for help. She was still fearful the suspects were still inside. She told the hotel staff she had just been raped, and she needed someone to call police. The hotel staff refused to call 911 and instead told her to immediately leave or they would call the police on her. As she was fleeing the hotel, she just happened to find a Roseville sergeant driving through the parking lot. The sergeant noted in his report, "I observed the victim exit the stairwell door. She was barefoot, carrying her socks and shoes and crying hysterically. She appeared disheveled and her clothing torn. She kept saying, 'They would not help me. I was raped and they would not help me.'" Thankfully, two men have been charged with first-degree sexual assault and are waiting for waiting trial later this month. These are just a few of the many stories our officers see firsthand on a daily basis at our problem hotels. Currently, we have very few options to effectively and proactively deal with this criminal activity and the public safety concerns. We absolutely support legislation which would allow for more local control and require these hotel owners to come to the table to help us address these issues. Thank you.
Sandy, you're muted.
Mr. Choi, would you like to introduce yourself and proceed, please?
Great.
And we'll take questions afterwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Choi, and I have the great honor and privilege to be able to serve the people of Ramsey County as their county attorney. And I'm here today to support House File 702 and the City of Roseville and all of their efforts to combat human trafficking. And I'm very aware of the issues that Chief Scheider has presented. And to be in support of my representative, Jamie Becker Finn, and I want to thank her for her leadership. I have been involved with the fight against human trafficking since the very, very early days, and it's great to see a lot of progress that has been made in this state. You know, we have a safe harbor law. Unlike many states across the country, we actually fund our safe harbor law. We've got way more shelter beds than we've ever had before. We've got a regional navigator system. We've trained officers across the state. We have better investigations. The prosecutions of sex traffickers has increased manyfold. But yet, we still have human trafficking, and oftentimes, in fact, the vast majority of times where these incidents will occur, will be in hotels across the state of Minnesota. And Roseville has very distinctly, you know, a number of problem hotels, and they have been trying to address these various issues. But when you have some bad apples and they're not being responsive at all, and believe that they can ignore some really reasonable requests, I think, that the community and the police and the city council are asking for. I think it is important to make sure that cities have some another tool in their toolbox, which is to create some framework of licensing so that the ability to operate in the city borders can actually be utilized. I think that's an important power that a city should be able to have. And so I stand here today to say that, you know, this type of power can make a huge impact in addressing some of the issues of crime, but also very closely and dear to my heart, really about the exploitation and trafficking of vulnerable people in our community. Because again, I will tell you that the vast majority of these situations will play out in hotels, and we need the industry to be a partner in that. And I want to thank the Minnesota hospitality industry for their work. You know, they were very proactive, very much in the early days of actually creating and implementing training for their frontline hotel staff. In fact, we have a great story out of Roseville where a conscientious hotel manager knew something was not right, and she intervened and ultimately called the police, and that actually ended up intervening in a sex trafficking situation of a teenage girl from southwestern Minnesota. So I thank the hospitality industry for their work in this, and also to the legislature, I think, passed a bill requiring this type of training. But I also think that the hospitality industry certainly does not represent some of the bad actors that we have in Roseville. But I'm also aware of other, especially in suburban communities, where they have hotels that are just not compliant with the demands and the expectations of the community. So I think this is going to be a really powerful tool in that fight against sex trafficking. You know, our work never ends, but I think one of the things that people need to do this work are the tools that the legislature can give. And I view this bill as being one of those. So I encourage this committee's support of Representative Jamie Becker Finn's proposal and bill. Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else that wants to testify on the bill? Okay, I'm not seeing anybody, so I see Representative Holt has a question.
I take it that's me, Sandy, Representative Hewitt, right?
Hewitt, okay, yes, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, testifiers. Great, great examples and great stories. I just have a real couple questions. And maybe this bill overall takes care of this, which I hope it does. I'm very supportive of the bill. But how are hotels different from such as like problem home properties? I mean, we see these in private homes, and you can label them and maybe do different things in a home than you can in a hotel. Will this law get us more towards that? Maybe I'm even dreaming on you have that much control over private homes that are problem properties. And then isn't there any law, and maybe Representative Becker Finn could go into this, that requires, I mean, training's great, County Attorney Choi, but training doesn't go far enough. Do we have to consider maybe putting mandatory mandates for desk personnel that if they are asked to help, they have to help? I can listen to the answers if anybody has them.
Okay. I heard a number of questions in there, so I'll start with Representative. Do you want to start and then?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I'll start with the second one. I think that, you know, part of the problem is that it's hard to prove a negative. And so as many of you might know, I've also worked as a prosecutor. And so, you know, someone failing to do something is much harder to prove than affirmative actions that they may take. And so I think there's always going to be a challenge there. And I think it is important to recognize as County Attorney Choi mentioned, you know, most of our hotels are not the problems. It is a handful that we really could use these extra tools. And I will say that the bill, if you look at Section B, it's limited to requiring compliance with state and local laws, as so it wouldn't be adding any extra burden. It's just if you fail to follow those laws and if those things are happening, the burden to pull a license is much different than the burden to prosecute someone or use those kind of criminal justice tools. I will turn it over to Chief Scheider. She may be able to speak about how this intersects with maybe single family homes where we have problem properties.
Chief Scheider.
Thank you. Yeah, we have a repeat nuisance ordinance that we use to address problem properties. It really doesn't fit though with the issues we're seeing at our hotel. And so we're looking for that be able to have that local control that we can sit down with our hotel owners and have set some guidelines of what we expect and what we need to address these criminal activities that are occurring.
Are there, and Mr. Choi, did you want to answer? I think there's a question for you in there as well.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, great. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for the question. I heard lots of bits and pieces in there. So I would also add to that with regard to the laws that exist, and you had asked about residential homes. I think there's tools that are in place. Another one would be, for instance, to utilize the public nuisance law. And I think Roswell may have considered this, but I think there's a long process by which to utilize that particular law. So I think the licensure aspect, I mean, I don't think a city can go beyond what the state would require. So as long as you're in compliance with all of your state and federal laws, any hotel should be fine. But if you're in violation of that, then what this gives is an extraordinary power to revoke that license. And of course, they'd have to prove that if it was litigated. So I think this is an important tool that would fit for this particular situation.
Representative Hewitt, is there any response?
Madam Chair, no, those are great answers. And like I said, I support this bill. I don't have hotels. I know I'm going to get them soon. So I would like every tool in place for my cities. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I did have, reading the bill, I did have some concern with 1.18 in that seems to not restrict it to related. It seems very open-ended. And I'm trying to get some clarification on, I understand the intent, but there could be some far-reaching or unrelated things that could be put in that are permitted by law, but not are actual required by law in any of the other statutes. I understand requiring noise and et cetera, those make sense. But that statement there of adopt a hotel licensing ordinance with any requirements otherwise permitted by law, if there was a way to make that a little more narrow to, appropriate. I just don't want something that was obscure and somebody found it and they said, well, I'm going to use this because I don't like this one person. So if the author could, help me feel more comfortable on that. Thank you.
Representative Beckerfin.
I have a really good answer for you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Quam, we're actually looking at removing that Section D. This was the way that it was originally drafted by House Research, but as we've had additional conversations and folks have reached out once this bill was scheduled with this committee, there's a little bit confusion about the community health board aspect. And so we're actually, this bill is scheduled next week in state government. And so we are looking at removing that Section D and amending the bill. We just didn't have time to get that amendment drafted with the timing of when the concerns were brought forward to me. So hopefully that alleviates some of your concerns.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I like the intent and understand the intent, and thank you. If you know otherwise, this is pretty much saying you can use things that are against the law in the state as conditions for having a hotel, I look forward in state gov to the amendment on this. Thank you.
Representative Meekland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I suppose the police chief, the county attorney, and probably Representative Becker Fink can all kind of help me understand. This is a big problem up here as well. St. Cloud has a lot of similar problems with, as these hotels get older and change hands. If perhaps you can clarify for me what current laws are on the books that help curb some of this as it's happening now. I know years back I worked on one of these types of hotels that had a water damage claim, and it was one of these very scenarios you're talking about that had a lot of crime, and every day there was police running by us and you never knew what was happening next. So if you can just help me understand like what currently restrictions you have or what laws, where this would make it easier to get these bad actors out of these scenarios and protect these victims, particularly when it comes to sex trafficking. That's a huge problem in the St. Cloud area as well. So if you could just kind of help bring me up to speed on some of that.
Representative Becker Finn, do you want to start?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I think the important part is, if you think about and this is why this is kind of coming through the local government realm and not a public safety realm. If you think of the way that our criminal justice system works is it is built to essentially hold people accountable for individual actions as they happen, and you're holding them accountable after the fact. And those tools do exist, but the problem I think with these hotels, which is also probably different than a single family home, is that it's a rotating cast of characters coming in and out of the hotel. So even if a county attorney in any part of the state is fully prosecuting individual actors, they might just be replaced with another actor that will continue those types of criminal behaviors. And so this is sort of a way you could think of this as a crime prevention tool. If we sort of have identified that there are certain properties that are allowing criminal activity to happen again and again and again, that then these conversations can happen where there's actually sort of a stick, I guess, to hold over. There's a quicker consequence with the licensing of the hotel to these, sort of bad actor hotel owners that can happen a lot quicker than a criminal justice process where we're looking at proof beyond a reasonable doubt and an internal, in the trial process and everything like that. So I hope that helps to answer your question.
Representative Meekland, response?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Becker Finn, let's just to make sure that we're not putting undue burden on someone who's not trying to be a bad actor or owner, I should say. Is there a possibility where somebody buys an existing hotel, and if they start getting some of these bad actors, as we were going to call them, and what would this? I mean, how are they currently? What are they currently doing to curb these problems if they're not if they don't want them? I mean, what responsibility are we hoping they do or asking them to do I mean, I get it. Some of these places just don't care because it's kind of their business model. I mean, I've been in them. So, but that's one scenario. But what about the guy or gal that buys one of these that wants to do the right thing, but they happen to have, you know, less than favorable customers that end up doing bad things? I mean, is there possible that somebody could get caught up in a scenario where it wasn't their own wrongdoing, it was just they have the absolute worst clientele?
Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I can give you the example of what the city of Roseville has tried to do, you know, multiple meetings and attempts to talk to ownership and ask them to, you know, institute training, to institute different things, to have a plan set up, you know, agreement to when these things happen, you will call us, you know, all those kinds of things. And, you know, if it were a property owner who was trying to do the right thing, that would be really obvious to the police chief and the city staff that person was attempting to work with them. And these sort of worst case scenarios that we're dealing with a couple properties in Roseville, the owners are not interested in it. And the reason it's continued to happen is because we don't have the tools. And, you know, I think our city has been around long enough to know that, you know, trying to get something through the legislature is not the easiest way to deal with a problem. But this is sort of the place that we're at in, you know, sort of almost the desperation to come up with more tools to address these problems, because our typical criminal justice process is not getting us there where we're able to hold these hotel owners accountable. So I know in Roseville's situation, I'm sure that there are crimes that happen at some of the other hotels, and I'm sure the owners and the staff at those hotels are happy to work with our police department to prevent and report those crimes.
Representative Meekland.
One final quick little thought. I, and this might have been a bill that you possibly had, Representative Beckerfin, a couple of years ago, and part of it was a conversation about mandatory training for staff. I'm not sure if this was your bill a couple of years ago, but back then in talking to some people that are in this industry, you know, their turnover is huge. And perhaps there should be like a video put together by one of the departments that is a training video, like a half hour video that all new hires have to watch so they can help learn to identify these bad actors and or if they suspect there's trafficking going on. But just how to identify it and would be something probably would be good going forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Beckerfin,
I think County Attorney Choi has a good response to that comment.
Yeah, so we produced a really important training video for the hospitality industry, not only for the Ramsey County, but also for the state. We first produced that back in 2012. And the hospitality industry and other actors now have improved on that. And there's a bunch of training modules and kind of a poster campaign, like in break rooms, to encourage people to identify trafficking, et cetera. And I want to give credit also to the hospitality industry that really has embraced that. There is turnover, I'm sure, in the industry. But like I had mentioned before, when we do have hotel workers, whether at the front desk or those that are doing the cleaning, it really can make a difference. And in fact, we saw that play out at a perfect example in Roseville, where I had mentioned that a manager recognized that there was just something not right about what she was seeing with an older gentleman and a teenager. And she intervened in that situation and ended up calling the police. And through the work of the police, at the end of the day, this victim who was being trafficked to Litchfield, Minnesota, ended up trusting the police officer who was trying to help her. And it was because of our safe harbor approach that we had trained officers who would view a victim as a victim and a child, as opposed to somebody who was engaged in an act of prostitution. And developing that trust, about an hour later, I think the police officer was able to develop that trust, and she told the officer everything about what was going on. But none of that would have happened but for conscientious, you know, hotel worker. And then also, and then that inspired the training in Ramsey County. And so all 75 hotels have been trained, and they have a 15-minute video as well that they use. I think that's video is still on Vimeo that some others still probably use today, but I know that's been updated, and the hospitality industry has also taken it to the next level throughout the state and also the country.
Thank you. Representative Meeklin, any response?
No, but that was, thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, that's really good to hear. I've met with many police chiefs up in the St. Cloud area, and this is, like I said, a huge problem. And we have to find tools to curb this, because I know how big of an issue it is. So I appreciate Representative Becker Finn for staying on top of this.
Thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one. So my always concern with regard to local government is arduous fees and that kind of a thing. So an example, I own a number of low-income houses I provide low-income housing to a number of individuals, and I am required to perform some inspections. And then one of the cities that I own a property in, they require me to go in and purchase a fee, like I have to get a license from the city to have this rental property. Now, I already have the inspection done, and I walk in with my inspection, I put it on the table, and they charge me $35 for it. Now, when you're providing low-income housing, the margin of profit is very, very minimal, because you're not there to make a ton of money on it. That's not the purpose of it. So my concern, I just want clarification on this, where it says in 1.11, it says no other licensing conditions or requirements are permitted. Does that mean that these hotels, these businesses, I know I've got a number of hotels that were just, they're in such rough shape right now. We've got small towns with, you know, interstate traffic is what provides the room and board for these places. Are we going to be, you know, do they get a license? Do they have to pay a fee? Will this be a requirement of them? Will the city be able to oust them by saying, hey, you have to pay a fee of $12,000 in order to have your doors open? Can someone provide some clarity on that? Because that's my only concern.
Representative Becker Finn, do you want to start?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I mean, I think the important thing to remember is that our city councils aren't looking to have empty hotels that are not generating business and property tax. And you know, the idea is not, oh, great, now we have this tool to put people out of business. And I don't think that's the intent at all behind any of this. You know, I'd imagine there may be some costs in administering a license, but as Chief Scheider mentioned, you know, it's 12 hotels. It's not going to be that big of a burden to manage those things. And I don't know if Chief Scheider has additional comments on that. You know, as a city employee and their goals with this legislation.
Chief Scheider, did you want to respond?
Sure. The intent is absolutely about public safety. It's about making sure that these owners that are not addressing the problems in their hotel, that we have some tools to make them come to the table so we can work together. Most of our hotels do a wonderful job of addressing issues. They reach out to us. They want to work with us. But in these three particular hotels, at least here in Roseville, we can't get them to the table to even start addressing these. So it is not a financial issue. It is completely about public safety and having tools to make sure our hotels have to come and address these problems and work with us to help prevent these crimes.
Thank you. Representative Olson, any response?
Well, I would just say it's an awesome purpose. We have to do something for this, and I love that idea. I just am concerned that because I was the mayor of a city, I saw how other, you know, I saw there were the people that no one liked in town, and because of that, some of the council members were against them for just being who they are, and I think that we need to do our due diligence, and I would really like to see a maximum licensing fee on there of, you know, but I understand the purpose of it. I think that the more tools you provide to a city, the better, but also the easier it is for a city to take advantage of their individuals. So that's my one concern, that otherwise it's an excellent purpose. We absolutely have to do something, but that would be a concern of mine. Absolutely. Thank you.
I am not seeing any other questions. So, Representative Becker Finn, would you like to do a wrap-up?
Real quick, thank you, Madam Chair, and I really do want to thank my testifiers. Both Chief Scheider and County Attorney Choi are very busy people with important work to do, and I appreciate their time and expertise that they shared with us this morning. We just really appreciate members' support. I encourage you, if you haven't already, to reach out to your own city councils, and I would guess that most of them would like to have this tool if they have similar problems with hotels in their communities, and would just really appreciate members' support. Again, this is all about preventing crime and making our community safer.
I will renew my motion that House File 702 be recommended to be referred to the State Government Finance and Elections Committee. The clerk will take the roll, please.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Byrd.
Aye.
Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Mecklen.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Joachim.
Aye.
We have 9 ayes.
Thank you. So the motion prevails. Representative Becker-Finn, you are on your way. Have a good day.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yep, thank you.
Next, Representative Freiberg.
Hello.
I do need to move your bill, House File 1359. And if you would proceed to address your bill.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the bill has been moved.
Yes.
Okay.
And it will be referred to State Government Finance.
Thank you. So House File 1359 would authorize wastewater operators to establish a program for inflow and infiltration mitigation work on private property. Inflow and infiltration, for those not familiar, is clear water. That's stormwater and groundwater that enters the wastewater system through faulty infrastructure, and that can be cracked or deteriorated pipes, root intrusion, things like that. In the metro area, private service laterals connect to city pipes, which connect to the Met Council's regional wastewater system. Bond funds and fee revenue can be used for publicly owned infrastructure, but there's not a program to assist with INI mitigation on private property. Inspections typically cost around $200, and repairs can range anywhere from $2,000 to $7,000 or even higher for homeowners. The Metropolitan Council Environmental Services estimates that about 20% of the annual flow treated at wastewater plants is INI. Cities and townships in the service area report that at least 50% of INI comes from private properties. The Met Council's been able to defer capacity improvements, which are estimated at $1 billion that would have been required if INI had not been addressed through the public INI program. The regional populations increased by 12% between 2005 and 2019, and that's been accommodated within the existing regional collection system. Mitigation work and preventing INI is more cost efficient than building larger and additional infrastructure to treat clear water in the system. The Met Council proposes to allocate a small portion of their PAYGO capital program, which is funded through the municipal wastewater charge, to offset this effort. Details of the program would be established through a public process with stakeholder engagement, and it would be adopted by the council. With me to testify is Kyle Colvin of the Met Council.
Mr. Colvin, if you will identify yourself and proceed, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kyle Colvin. I am the manager of the Wastewater Planning and Communities Programs Group in the Environmental Services Division of the Metropolitan Council. I have a short presentation that I would like just to kind of run through. Representative Freiberg actually hit on most of the highlights of the presentation, so hopefully this will be a very quick presentation. If you could... confirm that the presentation is showing up?
Not yet.
No. Okay. Should be coming. As it shows up, What I will be doing here is just giving a very brief overview of the Council's regional INI mitigation program and summarize the work that's been completed since the program's inception in 2007 and characterize the continued work needs to be done in order to achieve the goal of reducing INI that defers that $1 billion investment that Representative Freiberg highlighted. And these improvements would be necessary to address peak wastewater flow resulting from excess INI. Can you see the presentation yet?
I am not seeing it.
All right, let me try and load it up again.
It might have been sent to committee staff too. I mean, another option would be just to ask them to share their screen.
Madam Chair, there we go.
Okay, now we have it.
Okay. So let me get back to it here. Okay. So the Metropolitan Council of Environmental Services is the regional wastewater service provider in the seven county metropolitan area. We provide wholesale service to 110 communities, and that represents over 2.7 million people that use the system daily. This is nearly half of the state's entire population. Representative Freiberg explained the wastewater collection system. It consists of three components. There's the private service lateral that provides the service between the building on the property and the connection with the municipal collection system that's typically located out in the street. And then those municipal systems further convey the flow to the regional interceptor system. That's the system that the Environmental Services Division owns and operates, maintains. And flow, once it gets into the interceptor system, is conveyed to one of our nine wastewater treatment plants where the wastewater is treated. And in eight of those plants, the treated effluent is discharged into a receiving body of water. And we've got one wastewater treatment plant where the treated wastewater is infiltrated into the ground. And that facility is located in East Bethel. Of the 110 communities that are served by the MCES regional wastewater system, 81 have been identified as being impacted by INI. It's important to know that any INI that is eliminated is beneficial to the local and regional wastewater collection and treatment systems. The specifics as to how grant funds would be made available will be determined through a customer work group or task force and other stakeholder input. However, we envision that the grants would be made available to all communities served by the regional wastewater system. There's three primary goals of the Council's INI program. Those are to protect the public health and safety by avoiding system backups due to excessive wastewater flow resulting from excess INI. To protect water quality and the environment by avoiding spills into lakes, rivers, and other low-lying areas when system capacity exceeded by excess INI, and maintaining economic efficiency by utilizing existing asset investments and avoiding the need to expand sewers and treatment facilities that are only relied on or would only be relied on periodically during significant wet weather events. Since 2004, local communities in the MCES has invested over $260 million in INI reduction projects. The vast majority of work by local communities have been focused on the municipal or the public collection systems. Since 2010, there have been six state bond grant programs totaling $24.2 million, including a $5 million bond grant from the last 2020 legislative session. Through 2017, each grant dollar awarded has leveraged over $6 in local investment. In 2013, the council was given a one-time funding source of $1 million from the Clean Water Legacy Fund for grants for mitigation work on private services. Other attempts since then by the council and metro cities to get funding from the Clean Water Legacy Program have been unsuccessful, resulting in an unreliable source for local communities to count on for pursuing I-9 mitigation in the private collection systems. The council does not have the statutory authority as cities do to use its own revenues to assist with private property I-9 mitigation work. As Representative Freiberg indicated, the average cost to repair or replace a private service line ranges between $2,500 and $7,000. However, there are a few instances where this cost can be as much as $20,000. As you know, state bond funds cannot be used for privately owned infrastructure improvements, and funding from the Clean Water Legacy Funding has not been a reliable source in the past. There is a desperate need for a dedicated, consistent, and reliable funding source to address work on the private collection system. As noted before, the proposed change in the statute would expand the authorization to establish I-9 programs to assist private property owners with mitigation efforts by including in the statute townships or any political subdivision of the state where statutory sewer ownership or operational responsibilities exist. If passed, the Metropolitan Council would develop a program to provide a funding source for customer communities to implement private property I-9 mitigation programs. The funding source would reflect a small portion of the municipal wastewater charge, and those charges are the fees paid by customer communities that use the regional wastewater system. These fees and related revenue is currently used to fund MCES operations, maintenance, and some debt retirement. The program criteria and guidelines would be developed with input from MCES customer community representatives and other key stakeholders through a public process. Representative Freiberg explained the deferment of the $1 billion that a successful I-9 mitigation program would defer or potentially eliminate. Representative Freiberg explained that the region has seen growth between 2005 and 2019. And in the last 5 or 6 years, the metropolitan area has seen record precipitation, annual precipitation amounts. During this time period, regional wastewater flows have maintained a fairly constant flow rate or volume, thereby signifying some success to date with past I-9 mitigation efforts. There's also some influence with water conservation. So in closing, although much work has been accomplished both within the local municipally owned system and within the regional wastewater collection system, many communities are still adversely impacted by I-9 in both the private and public collection systems. However, without a dedicated, consistent, and reliable funding source, further I-9 mitigation within the private systems will be extremely challenging for communities. Further questions or information requests can be directed either to myself or to Janine Clancy, the Assistant General Manager of the Wastewater Planning and Capital Program or Project Delivery Group. And with that, I can answer any questions.
Madam Chair, your mute is still on.
Hear from our testifiers and then have questions. Next, I have Patricia Nauman.
Hi, thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to comment before you today on this proposed legislation. I appreciate certainly working with Representative Freiberg and with you, Madam Chair, and other members on certainly some of the public infrastructure funding that Metro Cities has championed over the years and has been very important to controlling I-9. And we do, I want to just take the opportunity. My name is Patricia Nauman, and the Executive Director of Metro Cities. And Metro Cities has the role of representing cities in the metropolitan area before both the legislature and the Metropolitan Council. So it's a unique role we play in the local government advocacy community. Again, we have worked very closely with the legislature and also the Metropolitan Council Environmental Services staff over the years. I think Mr. Colvin said it was 2004, and that's my recollection, as well as when a lot of the work on I&I really began. Metro City's policies do recognize the importance of controlling inflow and infiltration, particularly at the local level, for the reasons that Mr. Colvin outlined, which is both sort of public health and safety, water quality, and economic efficiency. We have long supported those principles as well. Metro City's policies also recognize that private property mitigation is a very challenging, vexing problem to address. It's challenging for cities at the local level and challenging and expensive for private property owners when they are asked to make fixes to basically infrastructure that is not visible. So it's hard to get support for these efforts. And it is expensive, as Mr. Colvin pointed out. Metro Cities has participated in work with MCES over the years on and city officials to discuss what sort of resources would be appropriate for this purpose. We have supported expansion of tools and resources, and I know the Metropolitan Council has done a lot of work in that regard. Metro Cities does not have a specific position on whether regional wastewater fees should be used for this purpose, but we do acknowledge, and our policies explicitly state, that if the Metropolitan Council does implement a private property program with the use of the wastewater charge, that local officials do be provided with the opportunity to provide input on any program. And I know Mr. Colvin pointed out that that would be part of the process, and I just want to emphasize our support for that. I'll just close by saying we do work very closely with MCES on this and many other issues, and we get public input, but and local official input, but I do want to stress that that's something that we would ask for if the Met Council does undertake a program and does get this authority. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to comment today.
Thank you. I am not seeing any other person that wants to testify. I also am not seeing any questions at this point. So in that case, Representative Freiberg, any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing this. This is
I'm sorry. There, Representative Meekland has his hand raised now. So do you want to take that first, and then we'll go through your closing comments? Representative Meekland?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Freiberg, it's never a dull moment when you get to talk about wastewater, right? I've actually worked on quite a few of these types of projects, particularly in Golden Valley. They have rules in place that when you're going to transfer property that you have to have them inspected. So I've done quite a few of these, and I know they're very, very expensive projects. I would actually say that your $2,500 to $7,000 is probably a little on the light end, to be honest. I know I've worked with putting these liners in. I still don't understand how they do it, but they have a way of doing it. But this program going forward, would this be like if a homeowner has this $7,000-$10,000 bill they're facing, where would they get the money from? Would it be something they'd apply to the Met Council? Would the Met Council give the money to the towns and they would go to the town? I mean, how would this happen? And would these individual homes now have an additional fee that they would be paying, and what would that be? Do you have any idea?
Representative Freiberg, do you want to respond?
Sure. Maybe for the specifics, I would turn over to the Met Council staff that's here. I can just say, yes, Representative Meckland, it is very expensive. I'm glad you mentioned Golden Valley's program. I am deeply familiar with that. I was on the city council when it was adopted. And I moved within Golden Valley about 2 years ago. So I got the liner and I got my sewer lined on my house, my old house when I sold, before I sold it. It was actually on the lower end. It was about $3,000, but I definitely heard from many, many residents, and you are correct. It can be $10,000 if they have a large yard and a long distance and a lot of root intrusion and cracks. It can definitely get up to $20,000 or thereabouts. The sewer line in my new house was also repaired. So, they did mention that there was funding from the legacy amendment from the clean water portion of the legacy amendment a few years ago, and they established a process that I happen to know several residents in Golden Valley took advantage of it at that point. They had a process where you apply through them. I imagine it would be similar to that, but I guess I would maybe for the specifics, it would be better to turn it over to the Met Council testifiers. So Mr. Colvin or Mr. Shetman, I think, is here too.
Mr. Colvin, yeah. Do you want to take that?
I certainly can, Madam Chair and Representative Freiberg. You are correct. In 2013, we had a $1 million grant program that was funded out of the Clean Water Legacy. And I anticipate the particulars of the program would need to be vetted through and developed through the customer forum and stakeholder process. But loans would be funneled through or the funds would be given to the communities in which these properties are located within to pass on to the private property owners. Our relationships and statutory authorities are with the communities. And so I would envision the program to be very similar to the 2013 program where property owners would apply for these grants through the local communities. Communities are very involved in the process through inspection and certifying these services. So it only makes sense that they are an integral part of the process. But I envision that the grants would be given to the local communities as a pass-through to the local, to the property owners.
Thank you so much. Any response?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in that last comment that or answer that it once was referred to as a loan one and twice referred to as a grant, are these loans that are paid back to the local city over a period of time, or are they grants?
Mr. Colvin.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Madam Chair and Representative. I misspoke if I used the word loan. These would be grants.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You are welcome. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And from what I'm hearing with some of the funding sources, there's a city, Orinoco, that's in my district that's the largest city without a central, you know, sewage processing and et cetera. And we've had difficulty getting funding. There is seems to be a great demand for, is it CPA? The acronyms get tough, but there's special funds that go for these type or help for planning and et cetera. What is the competition for wastewater treatment funding? I thought now we are underfunded by a great deal across the state. What kind of impact, if you go Met Council and now all the other cities, what are we looking at size-wise for the funding demand and requirement that could be added here?
Representative Freiberg, who would you like to take that question?
I guess maybe I'll just briefly respond. I mean, the existing statute allows cities to adopt these programs. All this bill does is expand that definition of city to include townships or other political subdivisions of the state with authority over sewers. So I don't know that there are that many of them around the state that would be eligible. The Met Council is one entity that is, but I don't know. I don't know if one of the testifiers, you know, with the acknowledgement that they represent the Metropolitan Council, which serves the metro area. I don't know how much they know about sewers around the rest of the state, but I'm guessing they might know more than I do.
Is there anybody that would like to respond to that? Do you have an answer?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Quam. I just want to jump in here. I'm not an expert in our wastewater system. However, I can say in response to Representative Quam's question that this program that we have is specific to the metropolitan area wastewater system that the Metropolitan Council is responsible for. And so that there is no competition between dollars that would be eligible for these types of issues in Greater Minnesota or in his district. We are containing this completely within our municipal wastewater charge, which is what we use to operate and pay for our system. And I just want to reiterate again that we are not looking to pass additional costs onto any of our wastewater users. We are looking to use a portion of the current wastewater municipal wastewater charge in order to create this program to really address this private INI issue that we're having in our system, where, as we mentioned before, we only had $1 million from Clean Water Legacy Funds back in 2013 to address it. So we actually think we're finding a great way to address this issue, be able to help out these private property owners by offering them some money that they may otherwise not have been able to come up with in order to address this particular issue. And so I can't speak specifically to what's the situation in Representative Quam's district, but I can say that it is unrelated to the program that we're trying to set up, because we are only able to work within the jurisdictional boundaries and statutory boundaries of our wastewater system here in the metro area that we were showing in the map that Mr. Colvin walked through earlier in the hearing.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Any response?
Well, Madam Chair, then to the author, my understanding this bill is across the state, or is it just affecting the five or seven county, or, you know, there's a few different ways of describing the metro. So isn't this going to affect across the state?
Representative Freiberg.
Well, again, like I said, the existing statute that this modifies, section 471.342, allows any city in the state right now to set up an inflow and infiltration program of the sort we're doing. However, the statutory authority is limited to cities right now. So all the bill does, and it does have statewide impact, but it also allows townships. I know there's a lot of those around the state to set that up, and political subdivisions of the state with statutory sewer ownership. And that's the language that's intended to capture the Met Council, because the Met Council does not currently have that authority. The city of Orinoco could currently, under current law, set up an INI program if it wanted to. But this would just broaden the entities, and, you know, I don't know if there are regional entities with authority over sewers in Greater Minnesota, but, you know, that the language that the bill would add is intended to encompass those.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I don't know all that could be affected by this, but I do understand the intent and like the intent. I just like to understand the secondary effects we might not realize of how this could, affect, demand on the clean water funds and other funds, just to be prepared. I support the idea and the intent. I was just trying to get a better picture of what are the, we come back and now we discover that there's another 25%. Demand on certain funding streams for, wastewater that we've got set up in the state. And that's where the line of questioning was. But thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Freiberg.
Representative Freiberg, any closing remarks?
Thank you. I know that this is an important need. This bill does address an important need around the state. It can be quite a burden on homeowners to have to fund these unexpected costs themselves. And this would be an important tool for various entities, but in, of particular interest to Met Council in this case. I know it's been an issue for homeowners in the district I represent, so I would appreciate members' support.
Okay, thank you. I will renew my motion that House File 1359 be recommended to be re-referred to the State Government Finance and Elections Committee. And Josh, if you'll take the roll, please.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative Elkins.
Aye.
Representative Quam.
Aye.
Representative Byrd.
Aye.
Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Mecklen.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Joachim.
Aye.
We have 9 ayes.
Okay. The motion prevails. Representative Freiberg, you're all set. Thank you so much. Have a good day. Next, we have Representative Bolden with House File 1350, if you would like to move your bill and proceed.
Yes, Madam Chair, so moved.
Okay. And the bill will be going to, I think it's going back to state government finance, if you would like to address your bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, and I do have an A1 amendment that I would like to move to get the bill in the shape in which I would like to have it heard.
Okay. Would you like to elaborate on what the bill is?
Yes, Madam Chair. The A1 amendment further clarifies that we are just looking to change the parkland dedication authority for the cities of Rochester and Duluth by moving the section 1 of the bill that was the general parkland statute. So this is a bill related to parkland dedications, and that A1 amendment is to put it in the shape in which I would like to make it specific to Rochester and Duluth.
Okay, thank you. And so if, Josh, if you would take the roll call, please. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, or are there any questions on the amendment first? Okay, and if not, if you would proceed with the roll call, please, Josh.
Madam Chair, you don't need a roll call unless on amendments unless it's requested.
Oh, okay. So all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Thank you. Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
The amendment is adopted, and Representative Bolden, if you would proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So House File 1350, as amended, would provide a helpful tool for Rochester and Duluth to have a better equity for park funding across the entire city. It would provide parity with the special authority the other two first-class cities, being Minneapolis and St. Paul, received in 2013 around collection of parkland dedication fees for redevelopment sites and commercial industrial. Current statute only allows cities to require parkland dedication if the property is subdivided or at the legal division of unplatted land. Minneapolis and St. Paul received special legislation in 2013 that allows their municipalities to require parkland dedication when most development occurs. This was due to the demand of development and redevelopment of existing parcels that does not require subdivision of the property, but still generates the need and impact for the park system. Rochester and Duluth are now experiencing this situation and are seeking state legislation to provide an opportunity to have a local conversation about how parkland dedication could be collected more equitably. This bill would bring more equity to park funding by equalizing the collection and use of parkland fees across a wider spectrum of properties in the community. Secondly, it aims to provide adequate parkland improvements serving the downtown area, a growing part of Rochester. We all know the importance of parks, especially in a pandemic, for mental health, community gathering, exercise, and more. I have with me today a council member from Rochester, Sean Palmer, who will be testifying on the bill. I also have with us today Mike Nigber, head of the Parks and Forestry for the City of Rochester, and Heather Corcoran, legislative policy analyst for the city, with us today. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And we are running overtime right now, so if people would be very concise, please. And Mr. Palmer, if you would like to identify yourself and proceed, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bolden, for your work on House File 1350. I am Sean Palmer, and I do serve the 5th Ward in City of Rochester. Our city council is a nonpartisan city council, and we currently have 4 new members who just started in January. I am a longtime advocate for parks, being a founding member of our Parks Foundation Board in Rochester. This bill will help or will provide consistency for parkland dedication. Right now, homeowners pay it, and then some don't and some do, It's only when the land is subdivided that it goes into effect currently. Whether you live in downtown or in a new subdivision, you should have access to parks. We are asking to have the same authority as the other first-class cities do. Let us listen and develop a parkland dedication ordinance that is fair and consistent. We have reached out to our developers and engaged them in conversations on this issue. And we will craft an ordinance to reflect the needs and values of Rochester. Treating people equally and consistently for all developers is important to us. We do have an example in Rochester. Riverwalk Apartments used to have 3 houses on it. Now it has 152 apartments, and no parkland dedication was used. We do look forward to continuing having this conversation with you. We appreciate your work and your time, and thank you.
Thank you. We'll go through all the testifiers before I take questions. Next, Peter Coyle, if you'll identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Can you hear me all right? This is Peter Coyle.
You are fine. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Coyle. I represent Housing First Minnesota at the legislature, and I have for more than 20 years. Housing First is the state's largest association supporting the interests of private home builders, suppliers, and related vendors to the housing industry across the state. We appreciate the opportunity to testify. I also want to thank Representative Bolden for giving us time yesterday to review with her the objectives of her bill, and the amendment she offered this morning is a substantial improvement over the original draft, and we thank her for that. Nonetheless, I still have some concerns that I want to share with the committee briefly in the time we have available. First of all, the existing statute, in our opinion, works just fine. Rochester is experiencing substantial single-family home ownership growth. The current statute allows the city to collect park fees off of any new subdivision. This bill, as proposed, would put Rochester into a special category and open up the entire city to potentially collecting double park fees on properties that have already paid park fees once. And we think that that's a very problematic outcome. Secondly, the language as it's been prepared doesn't provide any framework, any limitation, any definition as to how the park fee will be determined or how it will be applied. And we think that creates a lot of questions about how the monies might be used ultimately. We're aware, for example, that in Minneapolis, at least articles we've seen, their park fee authority has led them to have a substantial reserve, potentially in the range of $10 million from what we understand, that has not been expended. So the concern we have is that this is just another way to tax housing. And as we've testified previously in this committee, the cost of new housing in Minnesota is already skyrocketing. This is a step in the wrong direction, in our opinion, and with all due respect to Representative Bolden and her objectives. And we would urge the committee to not advance this bill and set it aside for further review. Thank you, Madam Chair. We appreciate the opportunity to speak to you this morning. Happy to take questions if there are any for me.
Next, I have Matt Spellman, if you'll identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Matt Spellman, and I'm with Minnesota Realtors. First, I want to apologize to Representative Bolden. I had intended to reach out, but my wife actually had our first child in the early mornings of Monday, so my time and my sleep has been relatively strained. So our association represents over 21,000 real estate professionals, helping buyers and sellers across Minnesota, transferring all types of property. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Our 2021 legislative agenda includes opposing policies that increase the cost of housing. I am here this morning to share our opposition to House File 1350, as we believe it clearly increases the cost of housing. Minnesota's housing market has a severe inventory shortage. Minnesota Realtors' latest monthly housing report for January shows we have less than 1 month's supply in the market. That means if no additional houses were put on the market, we would sell out of our current stock in less than a month. For reference, a healthy housing market that is well balanced between buyers and sellers is roughly 4 to 5 months of inventory. Coupling the current inventory shortage with the interest rates being as low as they are, the heightened demand on our existing housing stock continues to drive prices up, adversely impacting low to moderate income earners the most. Our most affordably priced homes on the market have seen a drastic jump in price, with the statewide median hitting an all-time high of $275,000. Minnesota needs to stimulate new housing development to bring balance into the market by alleviating some of the pressure on the existing housing stock. And in doing so, we believe government should refrain from adding to the cost of construction, which is ultimately passed onto the homeowner. I would like to echo Mr. Coyle's sentiment. I appreciate Representative Bolden's amendment narrowing the focus of the bill, but we still have some concerns that this is ultimately going to add to the cost of new construction when we actually need to stimulate new development to help balance the market. Madam Chair and members, thank you for your time, and I will stand for questions.
Thank you and congratulations. Representative Quam, did you want to move the A2 amendment?
Madam Chair, I'd like to get some questions with the questioners while they're, I guess, fresh in the mind.
I want to make sure we get the vote in before we have to adjourn.
I understand. Madam Chair, if there are any members that had some questions specifically to the testifiers so that everything's fresh and.
Okay. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Meekland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had the opportunity to meet with the folks from Rochester earlier in the week, and I appreciate the insight. And as I'm sure you recall, we had a conversation about what we've heard much here now of the lack of affordable housing. And one of the, you know, there's many concerns. I mean, we've heard bill after bill this year of things that would increase the cost of housing, from street impact fees to installing outlets in every garage stall for electric car charging. And the list goes on. And yet we have this never-ending problem of no inventory and a severe lack of housing, particularly in the affordable area. One of the other parts of this that I'm kind of concerned about here is, you know, you alluded to the fact that you're running out of funds to maintain the parks that you already have. But in this bill, if someone can answer the question, is there anything prescribed as to where the park has to be in proximity to where the fee was collected, what time frame in which the money needs to be used? And then there's the constant reference to Minneapolis and St. Paul, but we've seen the reports of the surplus they're sitting on that never got used. So perhaps rather than make out these special carve-outs for a few cities, maybe we should repeal Minneapolis and St. Paul's special treatment currently. But if someone could answer my first two questions, I'd greatly appreciate it.
Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will start, and then if my testifier, Councilmember Palmer, or perhaps Mike Ningber would like to chime in as well, I would welcome that. But I will say currently in the language, there is not a specification of the distance. I am aware of a potential amendment that speaks to that. The time frame as well, there's not currently language around that. Again, I think I would be open to those conversations. The intention is back to that sort of equity of funding for the park system. And I can say in terms of having a big, pile of money sitting and waiting and nothing happening to it, I don't anticipate that will be the case in Rochester. And that certainly is not the intention of this. The intention is to sort of spread those, spread the responsibility of that around. Currently, as it stands, the general taxpayer currently subsidizes about 50% of the neighborhood park development. Affordable housing is definitely a priority and important to me, and that definitely is a concern in Rochester. And the intention of this bill is not to move that in the wrong direction. Everyone deserves to have those green spaces, and we want to have equitable funding of those parklands. And so, with that, maybe I would, Madam Chair, with your permission, see if Mike Niebuhr would have anything to add to that.
If you would identify yourself, sir, and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Niebuhr, City of Rochester Park and Recreation. To answer the two questions specifically about where funding would be spent at, the current legislation that authorizes the park dedication under subdivision rule does not require a specific location, but yet the city of Rochester has adopted a quadrantized system to allocate the funding. So if you develop in the southwest part of Rochester, the funding stays southwest. If you develop northwest, it stays northwest. I would envision something similar to that happening locally in that conversation as well, because again, the developers and builders want to make sure that local area is served by their funding they provide. The second question is the spending time frame. And again, as Representative Bolden talked about, we don't want to have a pot of money sitting around and just sitting there doing nothing. We want to improve the parks and add to the park system to benefit these residents that want to live there. So again, we don't see that to be a real issue. We do have a concern though about limiting a time frame too short, because if you get small donations or dedication amounts, it's hard to do a project that would really impact that park system. So $5,000 or $10,000 won't make a big change. By combining dollars though over a period of time, you can do a project that will be very worthwhile for the residents. That'd be my only concern about raising it to a specific time frame. Thank you.
Thank you. Any response from the representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I do have a response, and I thank you for that. In the realm of doing this, if you're saying that the taxpayer is already funding 50% of the park, but we keep putting these fees on these new construction projects, which then people, if it's, you know, to be sold or rented, for that matter, it doesn't really matter, but this is then financed. And it's also factored into the permit cost of the construction cost for the valuation, which only drives up the cost even greater. I mean, I realize interest rates are low right now. They are not going to be for you know, into perpetuity by any means. And when you take a $5,000 or $10,000 fee, because it's not that much money in the grand scheme of things, but then you factor that into a 30-year mortgage, this becomes a very big burden, and it's just one of many that continuously gets added to our new construction. And then we all run around paying for surveys to figure out why we have a lack of affordable housing. If the parks are need funding, I just don't understand why we're putting this on the back of the very few that are buying the new homes that we have very few of, who then have to finance it over the course of time rather than spread it across everybody that uses the park. Maybe Representative Bolden can help me understand it.
Representative Bolden, and if you could be very concise, please.
I will be concise. In terms of the dollars, I think I just want to be clear on how much we're actually talking about for the consideration. And to be clear, this would be a conversation in Rochester with that sort of local decision of what that looks like. But what the consideration is $1,500 to $2,000 per unit. St. Paul currently has $1,200, which they've had since 2013. So it is not thousands and thousands of dollars, but is important for the you know, for those green spaces and parks. And I would ask, if possible, for Councilmember Palmer to be able to just chime in briefly as well.
Councilmember Palmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On Monday, we did meet with our Government Affairs Committee for the Rochester Area Builders, and they do have a realtor representative on that. And we plan on having a great deal of an engagement in how this pertains to funding and for housing. We are all aware of housing. It's our number one concern in Rochester. But we do want to be consistent and be fair with the developers. Not all developers pay it, and it all goes right back to the homeowners. And the homeowners are the ones who will be paying this in the end. And we realize that. But we want to have local control and make our own rules that fits our city. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Joachim, you have your hand up.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank Representative Bolden for bringing this bill forward. One thing I did notice during COVID, and I think all of us could probably attest to this, is walking through our city and driving through to our community parks, you saw them fully utilized, if not overutilized, because folks really needed to get out. COVID, one of the silver linings is folks were enjoying the outdoors, folks were commuting in our parks, meeting with neighbors and friends at a distance, and that has wear and tear on our parks. Our cities and townships are facing increased burden in maintaining a lot of different amenities that they have. Amenities that I have noticed, as I have three children that do rental housing, that all of their apartments advertise as something, come rent here, you're close to the parks. Come rent here, here are the amenities for the cities. So this is a way, this is a bill that makes sure that we're spreading that burden of maintaining those beautiful amenities across everybody that's using them. And I too am concerned about affordable housing, but as I'm reading the bill, especially on lines 3.1 and 3.2, this is permissive language. This is just giving cities the tool to be able to use this if they so choose. And they can work with each of their developers and how they're going to apply that. And I'm sure a lot of cities out there that are really concerned about affordable housing probably would waive that fee for those building truly affordable housing. So I just wanted to quick thank Representative Bolden for bringing this bill forward.
Okay. What I would like to do at this point, if Representative Quam is amenable, is just to take the vote on the bill right now, and maybe we can deal with the amendments in the next committee. Would you be agreeable?
Madam Chair, the concerns are, this, we've heard Rochester, this also impacts Duluth, and we don't know in 20 years what Rochester will be like, and that's why the amendments would be important. But I do understand the length and time, and I would work with the author on this. I would not be able to vote for it without the amendments. But if the chair would so choose, I would prefer that we actually, continue this maybe in the evening or at the next meeting time. Because I'd like to get it straightened out before State Gov is a very busy because of the financial deadline coming up. And I'm not guaranteed that we'll get sufficient attention to these details there. But no. it is your committee, Madam Chair. And okay. I will acquiesce to your desire, I guess.
Okay, if that would be okay, then what I'd like to do is move House File, take the vote on House File 1315, and it will be going to State Government Finance and Elections Committee. And Josh, if you would take the roll, please.
Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative Elkins. Representative Quam.
No.
Representative Byrd.
Aye.
Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Representative Hewitt.
Aye.
Representative Mecklen.
No.
Representative Olson.
No.
Representative Joachim.
Aye.
We have 6 ayes and 3 nays.
Okay. So the motion prevails. It will be, the bill will be going to the next committee, and Representative Bolden, if you would work with Representative Quam in the meantime, I'd appreciate it.
Yes,
thank you so much. I apologize to Representative Elkins and his testifiers. We will take you first thing on the next committee, on the next meeting. Thank you so much, and the meeting is adjourned.